We are talking about the Muslims as we deal with the cults, and we are coming to, I guess, the anticipated part of the study, albeit, at least for this particular study, you guys seem to have gotten into the history part of it a little more than the previous two, maybe just simply for the fact that this was something that was particularly interesting to a lot of folks. But as we've shown every time, and let me put it up quickly because I'm going to come back to the parts of this, we've said there are basically five things that are common to all cults, and indeed we've explored that, and as I say, I will revisit this in the midst of the lesson. But as we're talking about the history, and as we bring it up and did last time, and let me just start where I was, where I finished last week, without really any review, but to go back and put this last slide up, we had brought it to the 20th century, and with the basically the overthrow of the Ottoman Empire that came at the end of World War I, shortly thereafter in the various countries, the caliphate or caliphate was abolished by 1924 in all the countries. And as you go through the 20th century, what you see is much of the Muslim world outside the old Ottoman Empire basically got absorbed. When I say the old Ottoman Empire, I mean what we commonly today think of as the Arabic, many people do, or the Muslim world, quote-unquote, although as we've tried to stress, that's somewhat false. But that area in and around the Middle East that most people, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, that most of us would think, that area that comprises what we would consider to be the Muslim world. As it was outside that area, outside those boundaries, it basically was absorbed by the European powers. And then came the State of Israel, the country of Israel as we know it today, following the very short Arab-Israeli War in 1948. And the world's growing dependence on oil. I stressed that last week. Not going to really get deeply into the economics because that's not our study in here. But I'm sure you're familiar with this and you realize how the demographics of world focus have changed because of oil, primarily. And turn on the news today or tomorrow and you know exactly what I'm saying. You'll be talking about it in some respect or another. There's been an increasing focus on the Arab world. And because of that, religiously, there's been an increasing focus on the Muslim world, especially as you deal with the more radical elements, some of which we have talked about and will talk about. Now, increasingly during the 20th century, as we said last week, the Muslim countries began to be exposed through outside influences. This is a smaller world now. What goes on here, everybody in the world knows about it. What goes on around the world in some particular country, you know, major enough event, everybody knows about it. They saw it as a threat to their Islamic ideals. And as they did, they began to counter that. And religious groups began to counter that. The truth is, as we said last week, and I think you have to stress this, we tend to look at a Muslim country and we say things haven't changed there in whatever thousands of years. It's really a misnomer. If you were to look at some of those countries as little as 100 years ago, they might be radically different, and they might seem somewhat more advanced, and you heard me say that correctly, than they do today. And that somewhat is responsible, or owes its responsibility to these revivalist movements, again, which figure into the whole struggle coming from certain Muslim countries, like Iran or whatever it might be, and some of which we've seen in especially the last 30, 40 years. The advance of Western culturalism upon various countries around the world, you know, vis-a-vis democracy in China and India, etc., has led to certain groups within these Muslim worlds saying, no, we don't want America in our country. And so there's certain movements going on within these nations, and that leads to some of the extremism as well as what we associate with the Muslim religion. But all of that aside, how radically the threat is perceived in whatever country you're talking about, of course, coupled with the idealism they may have, be that Sunni, be that Shiite, or some other even more extremist group, some of which we'll touch on, that's basically what results in how extreme the response has been, whether or not it's just simply a crying in the streets or the mosque, or whether it's actually perceived in some bomb that goes off somewhere in the world. And so, you know, like I said, I don't want to get too deep into the political side of things, but just understand that all of that figures into Muslim idealism and how conservative or fanatical, depending on how you want to look at that, that those particular Muslims are. Now, I want to totally shift gears and talk about America, though. Because I really have talked about the Middle East, and I haven't so much talked about America. So I want to back up in history very briefly and mention something. Something obviously that can be a little sensitive, to be sure. But we're all aware, historically, that there was what is known as the transatlantic slave trade. It brought millions of Africans into the Americas. Millions of them, as many as 12 million, but an estimated 645,000 into what is now the United States. A number of you sitting in the audience, and myself, all have ancestors that figure in that group of Africans brought to the Americas. I have a great-great-grandmother and her ancestors that figure into that group. But nonetheless, during the 16th to the 19th centuries, a lot of these Africans were brought here as slaves, and many of them were coming from Muslim countries. Now, you might say, okay, what does that have to do with the, you know, we realize that, but what does that have to do? Well, it has a lot to do with the present state of the Muslim religion here in this country, and as I'll try to demonstrate. Enslaved Muslims were noted. Anybody that ever saw Roots, you see this exactly, because they tried to portray this. But enslaved Muslims were noted for their militancy, their resistance. They didn't just lay down and accept it. They were warrior people. Their determination and their education. And that led to some of the extreme laws. Muslims that came over into this country were highly educated. Remember some of what I was saying last Sunday night? That there was that, you know, long before there was the European Renaissance, there was the Renaissance going on in the Muslim world. That tends to be forgotten in this day and time. But when these people were brought over to this country, a lot of times they were being brought from nations where they were highly educated in their own right. That doesn't mean everybody, but there certainly were some. Now they're being brought here and, you know, told to go out into a tobacco field or whatever it might be and forget all that. And all of that contributed. We're well aware of that. It contributed to some long-standing resentment, et cetera, et cetera. Rising immigration also. There isn't just that population, but there's the explosion, especially in the 19th century, the 1800s. Rising immigration that brings in, and some conversion also, that brings in a considerable increase in the Muslim population. And this only accelerates in the 20th and 21st centuries especially. And that coincides, obviously, in the 1960s, well, 50s and 60s, with the civil rights movement, of course, in the latter half of that century. Now, put all of that together. What do you have? Well, you have a heretofore slave population, many of whom came out of Muslim countries and their descendants. You have immigrants who are coming not just from European nations. I mean, we might talk about the Irish immigrants, but of course, we also know we talk about the Jewish immigrants, and we talk about the Oriental immigrants. Well, we also talk about a lot less. And, you know, I don't know exactly why. Hollywood has never portrayed that, and schools never, you know, I never was taught this really in school, but you can read it, and you can see that there's a considerable Muslim immigration, or an immigration from Muslim countries into this country as well. Now, all of that is the case then by the time you reach the mid-20th century. Now, what happens? Well, Muslims in America by that time and today, become a very diverse group of people. As you can see, I put the demographics up here. If you looked at Muslims today, or at least in 2009, the latest statistics I had, but if you look at the groups, you would find that South Asian peoples, that is, people who basically their heritage is Indian, or Pakistani or Bangladesh, those people, which is very highly Muslim from in excess of 1,000 years, as we studied when we were looking at the history, they account for about 26% of the Muslims here. I asked several people just to get a feel of this, and I said, basically, what religion are people who come from India, what religion are they? Almost everybody says Hindu. That's false. There are a lot of Hindis who come from India, but it's false to believe that they're all of the Hindu religion. There are a considerable number of these people who are Muslim. Obviously, we know Pakistan is a very Muslim nation. Well, these people are immigrating to America. So today, what you have is about a quarter of them are from this background. There's also Arab immigrants themselves who account for, and I mean the traditional Arabic nations, that account for 26%. And then another 24% who are from various backgrounds. They might be from the lands of Indonesia or the Orient or certain African nations, etc., that are coming into America, Nigerian or whatever it might be, and they're Muslim when they come into America. And so that accounts for nearly a quarter as well. But another full 24 to 25% of all Muslims in this country are coming from African Americans. And these are not so much, and understand I'm differentiating, these are not so much the people that are coming from outside. In other words, 75%, 76% are coming from immigration. But a full quarter of the Muslims in this country, and is keeping up, understand this, a full quarter is coming from the African American population, and strictly African American population. So that if you looked at the demographics of Muslims in this country, you'll notice what I put here. I didn't want to get too far off into this, but if you notice what I put up here, most of that percentage coming in the last 70 years. And here's why I say that. If you go back to 1940, roughly pre-World War II, if you get to pre-World War II, the majority of African Americans in this country, if they are religious, they are not Muslims. They are of some Christian, quote-unquote, religion. They're whatever, African-American Methodist or whatever they might be, but some traditional so-called Christian religion. But in the last 70 years, there's been an explosion among African-Americans converting to the Muslim faith. And there's primarily been conversions in large urban areas, and especially, I was talking with someone after class this morning about this, but especially in prisons is this the case. There's a large movement within our prison system, very organized movement of evangelism within the prison system, among prisoners themselves, where people are being, who maybe before, you know, they came from some family that wasn't anything religiously or traditionally was some Christian religion, quote unquote, but now are converted to a very disciplined Muslim faith. And it's that discipline as much as anything that's attracting them to that faith, some of which we'll see as we begin to study the doctrines. And it's just contributed to an explosive growth. Now, as in the old world, remember when we first started this, we said you could almost look at a map and you could see a shifting around of ethnic backgrounds, descendants of Shem and descendants of Ham, and how they keep displacing each other. And it led to thousands of years of hatred, thousands of years of ethnic breakdown, resentment. That country belongs to me. Well, that country belonged to me and you took it, and all of that kind of thing. Won't rehash all of that, but there are old, old, old lines of hatred. Not just going back to Jews and Philistines, but going all the way back to ancient, remember, Hurrians and Akkadians, etc., etc. But as in the old world, those lines of hatred were drawn, so they have been drawn in the new. And we're well aware of that. And this has bled over into this religious struggle between, quote-unquote, faiths. It's contributed to the increase in converts. Because many people see it, depending on their heritage, many people see it as a loyalty to heritage rather than merely a matter of faith. Now, I'm going to be blunt about it. But this is the truth. This is something that you find if you talk to people. What's happening is a person is not just simply rejecting Christianity, whether they know anything really about it or not. They're not simply rejecting Christianity based on an exploration or a study of the Bible and a comparison of the Bible to the Quran and coming away with the view that the Quran is superior. They're rejecting Christianity and accepting the Muslim faith because one is perceived, this is perceived as a white religion, and the Muslim faith in this country is perceived as a black or African faith. Now, it's completely false, obviously, but that's the perception. And because of the perception, it's leading to an explosion of conversion. It's one reason. And if you'll notice in the discussion question for Wednesday night, I'm going to leave it at that because I'd like for you to think about that. I'm asking the question, is it the main reason? It's a fact that since 1940, this percentage has accelerated tremendously among African Americans converting to the Muslim faith. Is that the main reason? And that's something for us to think about and discuss on Wednesday night. But nonetheless, a fact that we see this explosion of converts. Now, contributing to this have been notable figures, obviously from the black Muslim community, as they call it, or used to anyway. But the black Muslim community, very charismatic leaders in their own right, obviously, have helped to bring about this explosive growth. They began establishing groups in the early 20th century. Almost at the turn of the century, you began to see this. Little cells, little pockets. I'm not going to get deep into that. But they were black supremacists. They were, and this is about all I'll say about it, but they were people who had been freed, obviously, by the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, the defeat in the war of the Confederate States by the Union, the ultimate freeing, obviously, of all slavery was abolished, etc. Now, following that, we all know that there was the era of Reconstruction, quote-unquote, the era of Reconstruction, and there was the emergence of the sadder state still of, the KKK and all of that mess going on, growing out of various groups who didn't want to let it in that way, is what it amounts to. And as a backlash against all of that, there was the emergence of black supremacist groups and fostering these ideals. Notice, not just equality, but supremacy. And there's a total difference in the two. The first one of these groups, religious groups, that you really see as an organized, established religion, was what is called the Moorish Science Temple of America. You may never have heard of that, but you might have. Founded by a man who was born Timothy Drew, who became known as Drew Ali, as early as 1913. It was an established group. Drew taught, and here are some of the kinds of things that you see, as early as 1913, so we're coming up on 100 years of this. He taught that black people were of, quote, Moorish or Moorish Islamic origin, but their identity had been taken away through slavery and racial segregation. He advocated, notice, 1913, he was advocating a rejection of the white or slave religion, Christianity, and a return by his people to Islam. And that set a tone, really, for people that followed. Notably came the Nation of Islam in 1930. You'll recognize that name, I'm sure, still going on. It was established by a man that is known as Wallace Fard Muhammad, even more radically militant, teaching, obviously, black supremacy. And he is the first one known to have, might well not have been the first one, but the first one credited with talking about white people and labeling them commonly as devils, all white people. Now, here are these men, Timothy Drew and Wallace Fard Muhammad. Quite a bit is known about Drew on the left, who really fancied himself, as you can tell by his dress. A really obscure guy. In fact, this was, I couldn't even find a picture, an older picture of Fard Muhammad, but he really was an isolated individual who kept himself in isolation, maybe for various reasons. But nonetheless, There are those two in the earliest movements in the early 20th century. Now, coming up further, some of the things we'll recognize, and you may hear some of the doctrines being espoused in your own lifetimes. But Wallace Fard Muhammad set forth three main principles. They serve then and do now as the foundation of the nation of Islam. One is that Allah is God, not Jesus, not Jehovah. Allah is God. The white man is the devil, clearly and simply. And leaders today will tell you that, just like they would back then. And thirdly, as he would, and I'm quoting him here, the so-called Negroes are the, quote, Asiatic black people, the cream of the planet Earth. And you can see supremacy in that. You can see prejudice in that. You can see resentment, hatred, etc. in all three of the, well, at least two of the three points. Allah's God, the white man is the devil. Negroes are the Asiatic black people, the cream of the planet Earth. Now, this was picked up by, and you should recognize this name, I'm sure, Elijah Muhammad, born Elijah Robert Poole, who became the Nation of Islam leader in 1934. He deified W.F. Muhammad. He said that Wallace Fard Muhammad was the incarnation of God, or an incarnation of God. And he taught that he himself, that is he, Elijah Muhammad, was a prophet who had then been taught directly by God because he was taught by Wallace Fard Muhammad. Now you have to understand that people that adhere, or did, he's dead now, but people that did adhere to Elijah Muhammad believed that about him. They really saw Elijah Muhammad, in many respects, at least African Americans here that bought into this, really saw Elijah Muhammad in many respects like people in the ancient Middle East saw the original Muhammad. Now, they would probably be angry at me for saying that. And they would say, no, we respect Muhammad, etc., etc. And they would. And they claimed belief in the Quran, etc. But it really was Elijah Muhammad. It got to the point where anything Muhammad said was law. Whatever he said was a decree that's to be taken like that, for he was God's ordained prophet. And now that Fard Muhammad, as he's commonly known, was dead, he was just considered as the incarnate God who had returned, obviously, to heaven or wherever. But this is the way Elijah Muhammad was perceived. Now, his message resonated. I mean, you might look at that and say, well, man, that's, you know, what an extremist. Who wants to believe that? Well, a lot of people. His message resonated with black Americans. Think about it. Let me go back and note the date. We're talking about a dude that comes along in 1934. So by the time that he is really preaching this, remember what happens. Over the next 10 years, within 10 years, African Americans in great numbers go to World War II. They fight for this country. They die for this country. They come back to this country, and they're still treated like they were before they went. And it leads to a tremendous amount of resentment. It's coming up on 100 years since slavery was abolished. And things aren't really a whole lot better, etc., etc. Now comes this guy along, and he's preaching. He's preaching to people that are still being mistreated. I can remember in my lifetime as a little boy, still in the South, going into a restaurant and there being two water fountains. I can remember in my lifetime going to the theater, Princess Theater, there in Decatur, Alabama, and white people sat in the lower section and black people were up in the balcony. So I understand. I mean, as a little boy, I lived through the last few years of that. This is when this guy came along. So when he's preaching, not just equality, but he's preaching supremacy. And he's preaching it to a people who were looking and desperate for hope and leadership. It's no wonder people bought into it. It's sad, but it's no wonder that people bought into it. Now, what happens, of course, is that he attracts a lot of urban poor people, to be sure, but he also attracts a number of students. College campuses become filled with young people who maybe had not much faith, if any, but now they're converting to the Muslim faith and adopting those ideals. Professionals. This is when, during his lifetime and at his preaching and so forth, you begin to see people like Muhammad Ali, people like that, converting in droves to his message and to his leadership. Now, notably one of his converts, not directly, but somebody got to him in the prison system, was Malcolm X. Small-time criminal, well, maybe not so small-town, but a criminal who'd been convicted, sent to prison. Malcolm Little converted to Islam in prison, changed his name to Malcolm X. Initially, he advocated a complete separation of blacks and whites, indicted white America, and once he was released from prison and began to publicly speak and so forth, very notably in this area even, he began to use the harshest of terms, speaking for Elijah Muhammad, right-hand man, so to speak, of Elijah Muhammad, talked of crimes against black Americans and so forth. Over time, however, I'm sure you know his story, his message tempered. He went to Mecca. He converted to a more Sunni form of Islam, etc. And probably that led to, at least I believe it did, you may disagree with that, that's fine, but I think it led directly to his assassination because of that. Because he was preaching a more tempered, far more acceptable message to many African Americans or blacks in this country. Now, Malcolm X eventually left the Nation of Islam while he was still alive, obviously, and formed his own black nationalist movement, made a pilgrimage to Mecca, converted to Sunni Islam, and even now is viewed as the one who started the movement among African Americans, notice, toward a Sunni Muslim faith. You have to understand, this brand of Islamic faith being preached by Elijah Muhammad and his predecessors was sort of a hybrid. It was a very Americanized Muslim faith. Now Malcolm X and others after him were teaching a real movement toward Orthodox, notice Sunni, not Shiite, but Sunni Islamic faith. And he still remains to this day one of the most influential African Americans in history. Still highly regarded, even though we're in excess of 40 years after his death. After the death of Elijah Muhammad in 1975, a division took place and there were two really dichotomous philosophies that emerged. Now let me put up and show their pictures just to give you an idea. There's Elijah Muhammad, and obviously there is Malcolm X. Now, Elijah Muhammad dies, 75, and his son, Warwick Dean Muhammad, began to reject a lot of his father's teachings, like Fard Muhammad's divinity or deity. He also began to accept white people. Remember what had happened with Malcolm. Malcolm goes overseas, sees, as he describes, light-skinned Muslims, etc., etc., and there was a whole change of attitude. And it wasn't just in Malcolm X. It was a change in a whole lot of people. So he's now accepting white people as worshipers, legitimate worshipers here. He renamed the Nation of Islam, the World Community of Al-Islam in the West, and later it was called the American Society of Muslims. Well, a lot of people went with that. And they moved toward, as I say, the Orthodox Sunni Islam, meaning they're worshiping like people in the Middle East. They were taking the chairs out of the temples and the mosques. They're observing Ramadan, the fasting and so forth of Ramadan. Remember that holy month now, because that's when Muhammad would take his trips out into the desert and receive his visions and all of that. They're praying the Salah, or Salai, and the pilgrimage to Mecca, and all of these things. They're adopting all of that. Really an Orthodox Muslim faith. But while a lot of them embraced it, a lot of people also rejected it, and we're well aware of that, and continued to embrace the more radical, and when I'm saying a lot of people, I mean African Americans. They continued to embrace the more radical views of Muhammad's father, Elijah Muhammad, and his predecessors. And that led to people like, and namely, Louis Farrakhan. Born Louis Eugene Walcott, this group, under his leadership, officially broke away and reestablished the Nation of Islam. So when I was saying back there, the Nation of Islam, he changed the name and all of that, some of you may have said, well, now, wait a minute, I thought there still was a Nation of Islam. There is a reestablished one under Louis Farrakhan, now based in Chicago. And notice, operating under the original militant teachings, he continues as their leader, and maintains a considerable influence. You know, it's debatable how much. The numbers get skewed all over the place, and I'm not going to even try that, but a considerable influence still within the African-American community. Now, chances are great. I would assume that. Chances are great. You know someone, especially in this area, you know someone who really comes down one of both sides of these movements. You may perhaps know someone of African-American ancestry who is more of the Sunni Muslim Islamic faith. They're very dedicated. They're not filled with hatred. They're not filled with with prejudice, anti-white, all of this kind of thing. Well, you'd be looking at someone who's following more the Malcolm X, the Warith Deen, Muhammad, etc., that line of conversion. You might also know someone who's of African-American ancestry who's very militant, very filled with, resentment and all of this kind of thing. Chances are great. Somewhere he's influenced, if not directly connected to, Louis Farrakhan and this group of people. And as I say, chances are great in this area, you know, one or more people following both lines of descent. And so you might, I don't mean descent, I guess descent is an interesting word to use there, but I mean descent in the sense of faith there, evolution of faith. But you might very well know people who are coming down those lines. Now, let's kind of summarize where we are. There's Warith Deen. There's Louis Farrakhan. You may well know their faces, especially Mr. Farrakhan, in some of his better days. He's a little older now. Outside America, there was a militant Islamic regime prevailing in countries like Iran, coinciding with what was going on in the 70s over here in America. The 70s were an explosive decade. And what you get is the rise of people like, in countries like Iran, I'm sure if I throw out names like the Ayatollah Khomeini, people like that, you guys will know, especially the older guys will know that name and know that well. You get names like that, you get people like that, you get countries like that who change, you get nations like Iran who emerge as Iran, the Shiite Muslim nation that it is today. And you also get these multinational. That means even though bin Laden is based, he's from Saudi Arabia. Yeah, Saudi Arabia. From a very illustrious family there, the Laden family in Saudi Arabia. But nonetheless, it crosses national lines. Goes beyond any country, based in any country. And it's a multinational group like his Al-Qaeda. Crosses lines into Iran, Pakistan, obviously Afghanistan, etc. And they're radical groups. His is the most well-known for obvious reasons. But radical groups like this, who are calling for jihad. I'm sure we've heard that on the news. Global jihad, even. A lot of debate about jihad and so forth. I'm going to get into some of that with jihad later, so I'm not going to touch on it right now. But you probably understand and know what that is anyway. But they employ terrorism, obviously, to carry out their goals. Still going back to that old rid the earth of all those who are not submissive to Allah. And, in today's terms, it's no longer a sword or whatever that can be wielded. Unfortunately, it's a button or a jet plane or whatever it might be. So it makes it very dangerous. Then on the other side, there are some very liberal and progressive Islams. Muslims, who by contrast attempt to carry on their countries, their nations, their governance, etc., by harmonizing their religious tradition with their modern, a sort of modern way of things, governance, etc. Their cries for human rights, and there's the struggle for that. How far do they go? How much do they allow? Saudi Arabia is a very progressive country, but its women still, have to dress a certain way. There's all that kind of thing. But it's fairly peaceful, not always, but fairly peaceful, at least as opposed to the militant groups like Osama's. But those that support these disciplines, be they Sunni and the more mystical Sufism, if you've heard of that and so forth, those that are supporting disciplines like that, we'll say there's more different interpretations of the Quran and the Hadiths. And they're stressing individual thought, which is a really radical movement going on, if you think about it. When it comes to matters of religious faith. So you have all of that going on. And that's what makes for a very diverse, view. That's what makes it so hard to study. When you start studying the Muslim faith, well, what are you talking about? Are we talking about Osama bin Laden? Are we talking about Muammar Gaddafi? Are we talking about Ayatollah Khomeini? Are we talking about Louis Farrakhan? What are we talking about when someone says the Muslim cult or the Muslim faith? And we, by no means, we just touched on it, barely, briefly touched on it. But you see how diverse it really can be. Now, where are we? Let's summarize and prepare to go into deeper into some of these doctrines, or at least to, you know, really draw a conclusion to them. We've looked at their compelling story. We talked about the founding of the religion. A group of seekers, those who turn away, the Hunafa, followed Muhammad. As it's often put, they followed him out into the desert, and they came back riding horses and wielding swords. And that's about the way it happened. They saw a particular need for this faith. Why? Because they see their religion, and this is what we have to understand, I don't care what brand of Muslim you're talking about, they see their religion as a restored faith, not a new one. A restored faith revealed many times through Allah's prophets, going all the way back, as you can see, to Adam. That's why a Muslim will feel very confident, much the same way members of the church will. We'll talk about our faith and we'll date it back to the day of Pentecost, and we feel very confident doing that, and we should, because it does date back to the day of Pentecost. But a Muslim sees this faith not dating back to Muhammad. He will be very angry if you try to contend that Muhammad started his faith. He will say, no, my faith goes back to Adam when Allah first created him. It's only been corrupted through time and repeated, and that's the important term, through various prophets up to and including, finally, Muhammad. And Muhammad is the seal of the prophets who delivered the repeated faith given through the ages. And the Quran is not corrupted, as they will say the Bible is. And that's what they're trying to say. So that's their story, and that's their need they see for it. We've also looked at the fact that it had and has been filled with very charismatic leaders. Obviously, the most important is Muhammad, who remains the undisputed leader and founder of the cult. They may argue with the idea of being a founder of it, but nonetheless, he is. But truly, they even see him again as that seal of the prophets. And these imams, from here on out, until we finish this, I'll be talking about imams and their beliefs. But imams, a lot of Muslims, especially the Shiites, are also guided by imams, subsequent spiritual leaders of the faithful, and hold particular sway over their followers, and account for a whole lot of the radical activities that are associated with certain Muslims. Now, you would see imams, even in this country, as an Elijah Muhammad. You can see the sway he has held, or a Louis Farrakhan, the sway he would hold over people. He's their leader. He's their spiritual leader. He interprets the holy books for them. He tells them what the truth means. And that's why such a leader becomes so important, why he's followed as he is. And you can get very deep into looking at that line of succession and all of that kind of thing. But just understand, when you're using the term imam, you mean spiritual leader. And some of these guys get very radical in their leadership and their discipleship. We've also looked at the fact that they have an alternate view of Scripture. There is the Quran, Muhammad's recitations, remember. His followers supposedly transcribed it shortly after his death. There is also the Hadiths, containing a number of teachings, examples, statements, etc., to interpret the Quran, to supplement the Quran, and basically addressing every aspect of life, making Islam an all-encompassing way of life. That's why Muslims generally are noted for their daily, everyday activity. Doesn't matter, even if you're talking in this country, probably most notably, you walk around here, you see a woman, she's got some kind of veil, if not whole outfit on, you know immediately she's of a Muslim faith. But again, these hadiths are addressing everything in life. I mean, even the way these guys bank, okay, the banking system is addressed in the hadiths. I know that may sound crazy, but everything is addressed in the hadiths. And finally, there is an alternate view of God. Let me just introduce it, and then we'll get into the core beliefs and the five pillars of Islam next Sunday night. There's a view of God that consider themselves, as we have seen, absolutely monotheistic. A different view of God challenges the biblical view in particular, as we will see. There's a complete denial of the Trinity. There is a complete denial of the deity of Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit. And there is also a complete denial of the efficacy of the blood of Jesus Christ, which is different in every respect, even from the two cults we've studied before. But that's enough, and we'll close with that. We'll get back into these core beliefs and these pillars of Islam, as they're called, next time. I really, I appreciate the enthusiasm about this study and the interest you guys have, and I realize that probably a lot of people that you're, if not related to, you're certainly acquainted with, are part of this belief.